Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're kindly joined once more by Alan Green. Alan, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Hello, John. It's good to be back.
So myself and Alan, we're going to be discussing a number of equities as we usually do on the weekly instalment of the UK Investor Magazine podcast. But before that, we're going to be discussing and just touching on and looking at some of the major themes that we're seeing out there in markets. And today, Alan, that is indeed inflation. Inflation's a topic that we've been discussing about, hasn't it, going back to the beginning of the year. Focusing at that point predominantly on America and, you know, the waves that we saw in equity markets on fears that there was going to be higher inflation and potentially action from the Fed. But really now that's starting to shift, especially for investors here in the UK. At that point, there wasn't too much in the way of UK inflation, but that's really changed very quickly. And we've seen a reading of 2.5% in the UK core inflation here, the reading that the Bank of England pays the most attention to. So that really does put some pressure, Alan, on rates. And we have touched on rates previously. I mean, in your view, I mean, looking at what's happening with this inflation reading, I mean, do you feel that there is a real pressure on the Bank of England to increase rates? Or do you think it's just a media storm that's being put out there to grab some headlines?
Well, personally, John, I think it's a media storm because where we are now as globally, not just as a nation, but our governments around the world are saddled with these huge debts resulting from furlough payments and, you know, the legacy of COVID and all the action that's been taken on the back of that. Of course, we've got companies coming back to work, exiting furlough schemes. Some companies won't make it, so there will be job losses, which will put further pressure on people's ability to pay mortgages, to maintain debt levels on so many levels. And I think that the Bank of England is really forced into a position where, although interest rates could increase by a quarter of 1%. I think any movement upwards at the present time, despite the big jump in inflation that we've seen, is going to be seen as it's going to send a shock through the markets, and I think it'll have an adverse effect. In some ways, it will drive investors back into safe haven investments. So you'll probably see any fall in conventional stocks offset by gains in commodities, again, as investors go back to safe havens, safe haven investments such as precious metals, silver, gold, platinum, and so on. But I think the bank is going to very much maintain the status quo and probably just see how it plays out. And of course, let's not forget, the travel industry is still on its knees. People are starting to travel now. And of course, fuel consumption is increasing. Oil prices, prices and pump prices have probably to some extent driven that increase in inflation. But I think if we see more money spent on travel and leisure going forward, then there is a chance that we may well see the inflation rates start to top out and hopefully even fall during the third quarter.
So, I mean, when we're looking at markets, the FTSE 100 is off slightly, trading, I think, just beneath 7,100. We're seeing actually, the falls coming from, some of the more defensive sectors. Some of the utility companies are down quite heavily. Some of those companies that traditionally associated with higher levels of debt are also slightly weaker. But where we are seeing some strength, Alan, is, as you pointed out, commodities, they're stronger. You know, they will benefit from higher metals prices. Some of the banks are higher. And that's something that we're going to move on and discuss in more detail. But, I mean, sort of looking at some of the commentary that's out there this morning, Andy Haldane, who was the former chief economist at the Bank of England, said we could see inflation going up to 4%. You know, in the short to medium term. And I mean, if we do see that, Alan, I mean, do you think that we see waves of uncertainty and volatility in equity markets here in the UK, particularly in, you know, the FTSE 100, FTSE 250, similar to what we saw in the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones at the beginning of this year when there were real concerns about inflation over in the United States?
Yeah, I think any jump in inflation from this point is going to be a worrying development because of all the speculation then concerning what actions the government may or may not take over it. But I think inflation would have to not only get to 4%, but it would have to hold and maintain that and possibly even show signs of going higher before the government acted. I could be wrong in this, but I just think there is so much at stake in we're at that transition point where the nation is starting to get back to normal. We've got the lockdown lift coming and, a promise from the government that that there won't be any further lockdowns after this. But I think the herd immunity, if the herd immunity approach triggers a huge increase in COVID cases, I think we could see probably regional restrictions come back in again, such as happened, I think, in Leicester towards the end of last summer, in summer 2020. It's a balancing act at the moment, and I don't think, and I think the government will be concerned about inflation, but I don't believe it's going to act until it shows signs that it is getting out of control. And, you know, 4%, that's a big number, but I think we'd have to sustain that for probably several quarters and possibly even push higher before the government would act on interest rates and change the current stance.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, one of the things that investors should probably take away from the data from this morning is the element of higher fuel prices within this rise. Of course, you know, if you look back to last year, we saw a crash in the price of oil as, you know, concerns around the pandemic and oil demand really sent prices cratering. And in one instance, oil prices were actually negative. So that's obviously being shown now, you know, the recovery that we've seen in oil, that's really being reflected in the figures that we've seen. So that's obviously a factor that will level out as we go through the year. So indeed, inflation is going to be a key theme in markets going through the rest of this year, and sure, a theme that we'll touch on again. But let's move on now, Alan, and look at, you know, one of those sectors that I did touch on as a beneficiary potentially from not so much inflation, but the potentially higher rates that could be caused by higher inflation in the banking sector. So when we're looking at the banks, we've seen them actually being some of the best performers in the FTSE 100 this morning. But Alan, when we're looking at these, it may not just be a case that, you know, people are potentially pricing in higher rates. We've actually had quite a significant development and announcement from the Bank of England yesterday, in as far as they're going to be removing the cap on payouts from banks in the form of share buybacks and dividends, which is a significant move. If anybody remembers back to the beginning of the pandemic, Bank of England said to financial companies, you know, not just the banks, some of the insurance companies, you need to maintain high levels of capital in your balance sheet. So they effectively told them to stop paying out dividends, which they subsequently did. We did see at the beginning this year very incremental and small resumptions of dividends. I mean, Lloyds paid out 0.57p earlier this year. We saw a penny from Barclays. Mm-hmm. But Alan, yesterday, the news from the Bank of England does open up the path for higher dividends. And remember, back to before the pandemic, some of these banks were actually paying quite substantial yields. Do you think now, Alan, looking at what they've said yesterday, that it's just a case now of banks, you know, incrementally increasing their dividends over the next 12 months to a stage, then they will be, you know, become real dividend payers again? Or do you think there's going to be some caution there from the banks?
I think there'll be an element of caution, but also let's not forget the banks need to, and they are in the process, of course, of updating and modernizing and transforming their offerings, because there's now huge competition out there from the likes of Monzo, Starling, Tide, and others. All these challenger banks looking to come in and get on the act. And of course, the open finance and open banking initiatives are really changing the way that we save our money, the way we use our money, and the way we transact. So the old banking names, they're great investments, but they have to move with the times. And I think a lot of the certainly the UK focused banks, whilst they've seen, I mean, Lloyds, for instance, has seen a very strong, it's seen share price recover 57% over the past year, currently trading at 47p, which gives it a market cap of 33 billion, of course. But with a dividend yield of 2.3%, that's attractive-ish. But I think if they decide to increase their dividend payment, they will become attractive to the funds again, and obviously more retail investors will get in and hold the stock. But they need to transform their offering. I think a few months ago they announced that they closed. I'm just looking at the news announcement. They closed 44 branches. In June, and they've just said there's a lack of customers going to the sites because everyone's moving to digital. So Lloyds has got the challenge, along with a lot of other banks, and also new challenger bank Metro, that of course has got these branches out through throughout the country, has also got a similar challenge. But I think in many ways Metro doesn't have the property legacy that Lloyds does. So I think provided Lloyds can offload the branches that are uneconomical for it to run, it'll be okay going forward. So we then look at the other banks, the likes of course, HSBC and Barclays, and Standard Chartered to a lesser degree. All these banks, of course, have international exposure. So they, and Barclays in particular, has a very strong investment arm. And although the first quarter figures for this year didn't impress, I think there are great expectations from the bank. And of course, Jez Staley, the chief executive, has come from an investment banking background. He's been the chief executive of Barclays for the past 6 years, came in 2015. So I think great things are expected of Barclays going forward. And probably it's the banks with the international exposure that have the greater opportunity for growth, both in terms of utilizing their technology to reach a broader audience, and of course in Barclays' case with its investment arm that that can really power those profits higher. So certainly my pick, I'm a shareholder in both Barclays and Lloyds, but I am looking at Lloyds, and I'll keep a close eye on that. But I picked up Barclays when it was on its lows last year. So I'm quite happy to continue holding that. And obviously the prospect of an increase in dividend is very attractive.
I just want to go back to an interesting point that you made there, Alan, about the challenger banks and what that could mean for your more traditional banks such as Lloyds, Barclays, NatWest. Now, of course, challenger banks aren't anything new. They've been around for some years now. But we're just starting to see some, comments and actions coming out in terms of consolidation. I mean, not so much a challenger bank, but JP Morgan have recently said they're going to be acquiring Nutmeg as they look to make a move into UK digital banking and investments. I mean, do you think it's a case that the banks that we've touched on, Lloyds, NatWest and Barclays, could be holding back from paying dividends because they want to be keeping some capital spare for making acquisitions to actually grow their offering, as you touched on?
Yes, I think that's absolutely the case. And I think, you know, let's not forget these guys are and have been the market leaders for years. And, you know, we've laughed at them for being out of date and stayed and lagging behind the times. But I think probably their teams have sat back and looked at how the banks are developing and how the offerings firstly are developing, but also how they've been received and used and utilized by people in banking today or account holders. I think we will see some moves coming from the banks going forward to acquire some of these operations and to streamline to basically buy the technology to help them streamline their own technology, but also to make sure that they maintain market share, because as more challenger banks come in, that market share becomes more and more fragmented. The pieces of the cake are divided up and become smaller, and that's a real threat for the UK centric banks like Lloyds. But I think the international banks, I think Barclays has always, it's met challenges head on, and with the credit crunch, of course, in 2008, we've still got the thorny issue of the money that was raised from the Middle East that came in and bailed Barclays out in the middle of the credit crunch. But nonetheless, it worked at the time, and Barclays is in fairly rude health today. So certainly, for my mind, and in looking at the sector as it stands at the moment, Barclays is my pick for ongoing growth from this point.
Fantastic. Indeed, a sector worth keeping an eye on then, especially what you mentioned there with the technology. End of last year, is reported Lloyds were potentially eyeing up the technology of Starling Bank. So that does reinforce what you're saying, that these banks really need to increase their technological offering to stay relevant. And on the subject of fintech, you know, listeners, do go back and check out the podcast that we published yesterday, which is with a Ukrainian co-founder of a app called Koto here in the UK, and a little bit about the story there of how that came about and the technologies that they're utilizing in increasing banking offerings here in the UK. So, Alan, let's move on now, and, you know, staying roughly within, you know, technology, albeit very different, the biotech sector. We're looking at Open Orphan, one that we've discussed on the podcast previously, mainly due to some outstanding set of results, a very acquisitive business. So what's the latest from them?
Right. Well, Open Orphan have had a very busy morning. They put out 4 announcements this morning. So I just think where the company's at, it's really worth revisiting the investment proposition to understand the business and where it's going. So just a very brief history. I think most people who know the stock know how it's evolved. Carl Friel is the executive chairman and really the driving force behind Open Orphan. He, along with his fellow non-exec director, Professor Brendan Buckley, this morning bought a huge chunk of shares in the company. Carl purchased another 1 million shares at 26.5p, so that's about 300,000 sterling. And Brendan Buckley purchased 188,000 shares also at 26p. Following that, Carl Friel now owns about 7% of the company. And I know when we've spoken before, you know, I always look at a company where a CEO or an exec chairman has skin in the game. And Carl has really put everything into this. And 7%, you know, that's a man that's absolutely invested into the business. So Open Orphan acquired HVivo last year. And HVivo, of course, owns the quarantine centre, the largest quarantine centre in Northern Europe at Queen Mary's Hospital in East London. That's that was expanded to some rooms in Manchester also. So they have an operation up there, and as it's made the headlines, it's made global headlines that Open Orphan have been awarded a contract by the UK government to undertake COVID tests, COVID testing to work through what it refers to as challenge trials, so where volunteers are given a milder dose of COVID and from there vaccines and treatments are developed. They announced first thing this morning that they had been awarded an additional contract by the UK government to expand on the trials they've been undertaking due to the success. Obviously the fact that Carl and his co-director invested and bought more shares in the open market, it's a highly significant indication of just where they're going. A couple of years ago, Open Orphan acquired Venn Life Sciences. In actual fact, it was reverse takeover into Venn Life Sciences, which was at that point listed. And Venn is a contract research organization, also has offices in the Netherlands. And another contract win was announced this morning in the Netherlands, €900,000. And Carl Friel said in that announcement that the company often wins new contracts, but only the ones that are worth around 1 million upwards are announced. So there's work coming into this company all the time. The company also announced that it had spun off some of its assets, some of its clinical stage assets for the treatment of infectious diseases, into a spin-off called Poolbeg Pharmaceuticals. And again, this morning it was announced that Poolbeg had successfully raised 25 million in a placing of shares at 10p, which will give Poolbeg a market valuation of 50 million at the IPO. And of course, companies often do this, particularly in the biotech sector, if they have a research arm that's developing a series of treatments, which perhaps could be regarded as an encore, then it's often the case that they're either sold on or they're spun off separately. And of course, that then leads to a boost on the balance sheet of the parent company. And of course, in this case, Open Orphan, because it's seeing that capitalization for the Poolbeg's IPO reflected on in the shares or through the shares it owns in the company. So highly significant steps taken this morning. And of course, I mentioned Venn Life Sciences and hVIVO. There's also within the group a huge genomic health database. It's one of Europe's largest databases of rare diseases, clinical and genomic data. And a patient for each data is worth around £3,000, and they've got hundreds of thousands of pieces of data. So the collective valuation of Open Orphan is rising rapidly. Company's now worth 179 million. And I have said this before when I've spoken about the company. If Open Orphan were listed on the NASDAQ, it would trade on a much higher valuation. We'd expect probably given where the steps the company has taken. And also the fact that the company were EBITDA positive during the first half of 2021. I think if you put those factors together, then the company will probably be trading on a valuation closer to 350, 400,000 if it were listed on the NASDAQ, which of course it's not at the moment, and that's pure speculation on my part. But the fact remains that with Open Orphan's exposure now to international investors, I'm sure we will see the stock continue to progress.
Indeed, I mean, I'm just looking at the the full years for 2020, a significant jump in revenue there. I mean, when you're looking at the shares, though, I don't know. Of course, I mean, there's been quite a steady pullback over the last, I mean, you've got to look back probably 2 or 3 months now to beginning of April, which actually coincided with some of the news about, you know, potential spin-offs. I mean, do you think that was, you know, wasn't taken very well by the market? Do you think there was an element of disappointment there looking back that some of these assets would be then put into a new entity?
I think what often happens, it's the old saying in the stock market, isn't it? It's better to travel sometimes than to arrive. So the numbers were expected, and as Carl said in the full year statement, it's not simply satisfied to return to a positive operating position at the end of 2020, and it's targeting to deliver a full year profit in 2021. But earnings are materially improving, and the spin-off with Paul Big Pharma will really add further beef into the open orphan balance sheet. But there has been a pullback in small cap stocks, generally speaking, and I think the reason for the open orphan pullback is nothing more than that. It's also the same with other pharmaceutical companies and companies involved in biotech. Destiny Pharma, for instance, shares in that have also retreated slightly. And I think it's just, there is just a general malaise in the markets at the moment. And I think also investors, you know, given the uncertainty, given the transition I spoke about earlier, I think a lot of people are possibly sitting on their hands and maybe taking profits. But nonetheless, the underlying business is at Open Orphan is very strong indeed. And I think, you know, the news this morning, particularly the fact that Carl Friel has, you know, stuck his hand in his pocket, spent another $300,000 on shares in the business. That's hugely significant. And I think we'll see a floor under the shares from this point onwards.
Yes, indeed. I mean, looking at the share price in the, you know, most recent times, it seems to be the buyers are starting to come back in. So certainly going to be an interesting story to watch for the rest of 2020. So just as a recap there on the equities discussed today, we touched on Lloyds, which trades under the ticker of LLOY. There was Barclays, trades under the ticker of BARC. And just then was Open Orphan, which trades under the ticker of ORPH. Alan, thank you much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you, John.
So just as I touched on in the middle of the podcast, do check out our most recent podcast as well, because there's some interesting background into some of the themes that we've discussed today, particularly fintech here in the UK. Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.